Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Konnichiwa. Age of Influence というインフルエンサーマーケティングに関する本を書いたニール・シェイファーと申します。よろしくお願いします。これからマーケティングブックポッドキャストが始まります。This is the same Neil Schaefer, author of The Age of Influence, The Power of Influencers to Elevate Your Brand, and you, my friend, in multiple languages throughout the world, are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Neil Schaefer to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his newest book, The Age of Influence, The Power of Influencers to Elevate Your Brand, published by HarperCollins. Neil Schaefer is a leading authority on helping businesses through their digital transformation of sales and marketing through consulting, training, and helping companies of all sizes with social media marketing strategy, influencer marketing, and social selling initiatives. President of the social media agency PDCA Social, Neil also teaches digital media to executives at Rutgers University, the Irish Management Institute in Ireland, and the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. And interesting fact, he speaks fluent Japanese and Mandarin Chinese. Neil, congratulations on the Age of Influence, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas, or should I say xiexie, or should I say arigato?
Oh, wow. I don't know what those mean, but they sound really cool. So, as I mentioned, you know, you speak Japanese and Chinese, and as the listeners heard at the very beginning, they may have thought they were listening to a Japanese podcast, and there are listeners in Japan, so shout out to my homies in Japan. But you also attended flight attendant school for All Nippon Airways, and this was as part of an influencer campaign they were doing, and your fluency in Japanese. Did you also have the opportunity to serve as a flight attendant, Neil Schaefer?
You know, unfortunately, I didn't. I was looking forward to getting the complete brand experience, but it stopped at the school I don't know what it was about me, but yeah, something turned them off. But no, it was a fascinating experience. And, you know, we talk about, and we're going to talk obviously about influencers, what have you, but really, you know, bringing them into your brand and showcasing who you are and allowing them to talk about you like we're doing now. It was an amazing experience, and I think sort of a best case, a case study that other brands can learn from.
Absolutely. So this is episode 292 of the Marketing Book Podcast, and you were on before for episode 48 and in December of 2015. So Neil Schaefer, you were an early supporter of the Marketing Book Podcast, and for that, I'm grateful. And that's when we talked about your book, Maximize Your Social, A One-Stop Guide to Building a Social Media Strategy for Marketing and Business Success. Excellent, excellent book. And I'm going to include a link to that interview. So I am now assuming that you will come back on the Marketing Book Podcast every 244 episodes. So just so you know, Neil Schaefer, I'm holding open episode 536 for you. It's penciled in, and that will be on, everyone mark your calendars, that will be April 18th in the year 2025.
Oh, I'll be on before that, my friend.
Oh, maybe there's some more books in the works?
Well, you know, it's funny, because this book was published in March of 2020. It's brand new.
March 17th, right?
Yeah, March 17th. But as you know, with working with a traditional publisher, the actual content was written several months before that. So I have already, I think with, you know, Douglas, maybe you're the same, but with the coronavirus pandemic and time at home and what have you, I've sort of had a creative renaissance in terms of content creation and what have you. And I know a lot of other marketers out there, maybe some of you are nodding. So I'm already looking ahead to my next book, which I think will be really appropriate for the times we live in. And yeah, I'm hoping to get started on that in the next 2 to 3 months.
Oh, excellent. Well, please keep me posted, because I know this guy who hosts a podcast where he interviews authors of new marketing and sales books. And I'm not sure about him, but his guests are phenomenal. And actually, there was an author I spoke to not too long ago on the limited time series called Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails, where I had past guests come back on. And it was Alan Gannett, and he wrote The Creative Curve. And he was referring to this era as a externally imposed writer's sabbatical. He hadn't been planning to do his start his next book, but he said, "Boy, I better get going here." So now your name is Schaefer, and you teach at Rutgers.
I just want to say I just write the books to be on the podcast.
Oh, well, I'm so excited to know that I'm offering up goals for people. Well, that's good. That's good. Boy, now the pressure's on me. Boy, I better up my game here. Now, your name is Schaefer, and you teach at Rutgers. Mark Schaefer, different spelling, also teaches at Rutgers. And I'm just curious, is it a requirement to be named Schaefer and write books about social media in order to get a teaching position at Rutgers University?
You know, there's something called the Schaefer conspiracy. If you do a search, you're not going to find it in Google. You got to go deep in Reddit. But if you look hard enough, you might just find it.
Wow. So it just seems like there's a real secret society going on there. And I think it's very clever that you guys spell your names slightly differently so that throws right. People off the scent of the trail. So you sent me a copy of your book, and I was very excited to get it, and you very nicely autographed it for me. And, some people collect autographed sports memorabilia. That's great. I don't. I collect autographed sales and marketing books. And in it, you wrote, "Douglas, thank you so much for all your support over the years. I hope you find this book to be podcast material." My friend, this is even beyond podcast material. This book is beautifully written, and I mean that in all sincerity. This book is written better than it had to be, as I like to sometimes say. It was beautifully written, and you set the stage. And I think if someone never read a influencer marketing book, this would be a great one to start. But sometimes, see, I don't read the book. I get a handle on the book and see if it might be a fit for the audience and if it's one I want to read. But I don't actually read it until the week before the interview, so it's still fresh in my mind. And occasionally I get hold of a book like this and I get even more excited as I'm reading it because it was so well written. So hats off to you. Maybe it's an Amherst thing. I don't know.
Hey, I really sincerely appreciate it. This was really, a labor of love in many ways. And because of the process I took to write the book, which we could talk about if you're interested, but I needed to make sure that the content was as evergreen as possible, knowing that it was going to be published several months after I was done writing. So I really did many, a lot of edits and re-edits to make sure that the principles and the concepts would be clear and they would withstand the test of time. So I'm ecstatic that you you found it to be of such high quality.
This is going to be relevant. This is going to have a long shelf life, I think. I mean, you did talk in one chapter about a couple of the tools, and I'm sure some of the I can almost guarantee some of those tools are still going to be there. But otherwise, the context, this helped to rewire part of my marketing brain. And yes, I do have a brain, but it helped. I mean, even though all these books that I've read, this, I learned so much for it. And I want to quote from it before we start talking about some of the specifics. Several months ago, when I was in the market for a new phone, I went to my local T-Mobile store here in Southern California. While going through the upgrade process with the salesperson, the inevitable question came up, "What do you do for a living?" That's not always a quick question to answer. My work as a marketing educator and consultant means I have many roles, including as a public speaker, an author, or even working as an influencer. What makes this question more difficult is the general misconceptions that surround influencer marketing. It was surprisingly easier to answer the question this time. In the modern day gig economy, people often have multiple jobs. It turned out the salesperson was a local level influencer himself who worked with nearby businesses to demonstrate the most effective ways for them to engage with influencers at events for business benefits. In many ways, this interaction highlights why I've written this book. And then on another page, you write, "In recent years, many books, podcasts, blog posts, and TED Talks have discussed the best ways to build your social media presence or to develop influence on a personal scale. Many blueprints for developing your personal brand have been published. The Age of Influence does not do that. While part of this book discusses how to grow more influential on social networks, my focus here is on engaging the voices of influencers, leveraging the other, as I call it, to spread your message. It's investing what power you have to move outside and incite word of mouth marketing so that other voices will talk about your business. It is not about merely building brand, but giving you the tools to engage influential voices for a variety of business objectives. It is about returning to the original premise of engaging in social media, inciting word of mouth conversations about your brand." So, Neil, take us back to why the interaction with your phone salesman is what led you to write this book.
Well, I wouldn't say that particular instance led me to write the book. It was one of a number of situations I was in where I actually, when I met that salesman, I was in the process of writing the book. And, you know, when you write books or you're a speaker, it's all about storytelling, right? And I think, you know, good authors are able to weave personal stories and experiences to better showcase what they're talking about. And after I had that conversation, I thought that would be just a perfect way to open up the book, to get people into the shoes I'm in. I'd say what really struck me, the reason, you know, that I found that there was a lot of confusion, a lot of questions in the market about influencers, influencer marketing, was when I sat in and taught at a MBA class on marketing here at USC, invited by the professor. And he said, "Neil, you know, do your thing on social media platforms and social media strategy, social media ROI." And at the end, where I usually get a ton of questions, this is where I really gauge where the audience is. And it's actually the reason I wrote Maximize Your Social back in 2013 was that back in 2012, I was getting questions about how do you create a social media strategy? How do you measure social media ROI? And I think the market, the industry, we've matured since then. But back then at the USC class, and it wasn't the first time, but I wasn't getting questions. And these were, you know, MBA students, late 20s, early 30s. A lot of them were working full-time and taking the classes part-time in the evening. It wasn't just about how do we leverage influencers for our business, but it was also how do we become more influential? And of course, this is Los Angeles, right? So I have a friend, they get paid, you know, $1,000 when they post a photo of a ring on Instagram. And a lot of people were telling me these anecdotal stories of people that were in their network that were actually gaining a monetary benefit from being influential. So that really struck me as being something, you know, why am I getting all these questions asked about this? And then when I had my radar up, my antennas up, as I spoke more, I would get more and more questions. So I decided to do a little bit of research on the topic. I'm not going to say I'm an influencer marketing expert by any means at that point in time, but I wanted to understand what was going on. And at the time, Douglas, I realized that, you know, the influencer marketing that people were talking about was all part of this digital concept of influence. People are only talking about, you know, the Instagrammers and now the TikTokers. They weren't talking about the B2B influencers that are being invited to webinars or that are appearing on podcasts or the companies that spend money trying to reach out to bloggers with higher domain authority in hopes of getting a backlink. These are all part of digital influence and companies and people trying to get more influential through various means and companies trying to tap into that for various business objectives. So when I looked at it that way, it just all seemed to make sense that there was this completely hidden picture of influencer marketing. This is where, you know, in the words of Steve Jobs, you connect the dots. I connected it to all these other things. That leverage the other is something I've been talking about since like 2013, really with the emergence of employee advocacy. In fact, in Maximize Your Social, I might have mentioned the word, not sure, but it was around that time. And really, you know, employee advocacy is the same thing. You're leveraging other voices. And what's really happened, Douglas, over the last few years is as I was doing my research, I realized the trends, right? The trends of social media becoming pay to play, the trends of people distrusting advertisements, the trends of people wanting to relate to people like them and know, like, and trust people that are like them instead of it all seemed to come into place. And it all seemed to make sense to me, really clear sense. But I realized that, you know, Douglas, when we talk about influencers, in the words of some people, marketers cringe, right? They have this preconception of it's only for B2C brands. It's only targeting younger people. It's only people that we've never heard of with millions of followers and we're paying for vanity likes. And I think they completely miss out on the opportunities that are there once they open their eyes and do a reset of their mind. And that's why, you know, that forward and the first part of the age of influence really is reset your mind, understand the trends, and see the power that leveraging the other and working with other social media users. I literally think it's the only thing brands can do, you know, if they want to avoid pay to play right now to really be heard. And even with coronavirus, Douglas, I think all those trends I talked about, it only accelerates. I think, you know, the type of influencer that would always be seen in an exotic location, like in the perfect photo, those people are being replaced by nano influencers, micro influencers, people that are showing up without makeup, people that are showing up in their house in their pajamas. People relate to it. People, you know, they relate to people that are like them. And we're finding a whole new generation of sort of real influencers are now emerging. And even those influencers that used to in the Instagram world always have the Instagram perfect look, they're needing to change as well. Because in the coronavirus days that we live in right now, it begins to look a little artificial, right? A little bit removed from our common life. So the industry will continue to evolve, but those trends and the fact that there's a lot of people around you that you can tap into, I think that's a universal truth. And what's been really exciting, Douglas, I know you probably have a load of other questions to ask me, is after writing the book and sending it out to, you know, to people for reviews or what have you, there are two other authors who are writing similar books who literally said, Neil, you know, there's overlap with my book, but yes, there's so much potential that businesses don't see. So thank you for writing the book. One's going to come out in September. Another one's going to come out early next year. So I think we're going to hear a lot more talk about influencer marketing the right way.
Oh, wow. So can you share with us who the other two authors are?
Yes. Yeah, so one is probably someone you've heard of, Jason Falls.
Yeah. I've never interviewed him. Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah. No BS social media. He actually had me on his podcast. And we talked about it.
And
he's like, it's amazing how we can cover it from two different angles with overlap. But you know, fundamentally, we both have the same view. The other is a professor. She was a professor at UCLA, now at University of Texas at Austin. Her name is Amanda Russell. Hers actually comes out in September. The electronic version coming out in August. Her book's called The Influencer Code. I'm not sure about the name of Jason's book. But yeah, I'm excited that there's going to be more, there will be more books on the subject so that there's more for us to discuss.
Well, the main thing I wanted to ask you, if we just stop the interview right now, you're really influential. You're a big influencer. You live in LA. Be honest. Do Kim Kardashian and Kanye West come over and hang out at your house all the time?
Dude, we have them over for Taco Tuesdays with LeBron James.
Wow. Neil Schaefer, you're my hero. But seriously, folks, you said what I was thinking, which is my hunch is that you said you use the word cringe. You know, sometimes you hear this word influencer marketing and people think that influencer marketing might be all about hiring Kim Kardashian to tweet about your product and that it's really expensive. And I didn't necessarily think that, but I have a much deeper understanding of why this is. I know you may have be upset to hear this, but it's really coming into its own. It's becoming so much more important. But after you're reading a book, I can definitely say it's definitely not the case. There are big opportunities for business-to-business brands. You have many examples in there. And it doesn't have to cost a lot, which you say surprises a lot of people, and that there's riches and niches. But I've got, you should never say which of your kids is your favorite one. I've got to tell you what my favorite part of the book was, and it was actually towards the beginning. And you talk about establishing a baseline of understanding for your reader. And I was wondering if we could first just touch on that, take a few steps back and kind of set the stage for why influencer marketing makes so much sense now. So you write that the very essence of how messages are spread has shifted. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So I go through a little history lesson at the beginning of the book, right?
Yeah, let's do that.
And it's really, what you see with influencer marketing is an extension of the celebrity endorsement that's been around for hundreds of years. So,
Yes, except, spoiler alert, you go on to explain that people trust influencers more than celebrities. People are more mistrustful of celebrities.
Yeah. So, just going through that revolution, before the internet, we had TV, Michael Jordan and Nike, Michael Jackson, Pepsi, Shaquille O'Neal, Buick. We've always had this notion of celebrities appearing on advertisements. And before that, there was radio and there was Babe Ruth and Charlie Chaplin in newspapers, what have you. So, but what's happened now, and Douglas, the way I like to put it, and if I could rewrite the book today, I'd talk about this. When I was in high school, and I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm going to age myself. When I think I was a senior in high school, Top Gun came out. And a week after Top Gun came out, one of my good friends all of a sudden started riding a motorcycle and wearing a black leather jacket, to be like Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. And the people we talked about back then were all famous celebrities, right? Because it was limited communication channels, what have you. Talk to your kids today about who influences them. It's not the famous people like it was for us. It's people that chances are you've never heard of.
Yes, and it's amazing how they find them and who they are. And it's definitely not celebrity. They're just. I think there's also some mistrust. And I'm just amazed at how they find these people. So
it's a lot of it. Yeah, I mean, some of it's just searching. It's obviously a lot of word of mouth. It's someone at school and what have you. But then you get to someone like Charlie. Damalu, I think is her last name, on TikTok. And she came out of nowhere, right? Huge on TikTok. She was on a TV commercial during the Super Bowl. So when we talk about the Kardashians or we talk about the Charlies, they have now graduated from a pure social media influencer to become a traditional celebrity. So when I talk about influencers, I'm talking about people that are they're not on TV, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're on YouTube. But, so when you get to like gamers are just a perfect example of, people my son follows. My daughter will follow like fitness influencers, people I've never heard of, but you go to their YouTube channel and they have millions of subscribers, right? Mm-hmm. And so they are influencing the generation of today like we were influenced by celebrities in the past. But this is only business to consumer to Gen Z, right? When you're looking for information on something, related to business, you might be listening to a podcast. Heck, you might be listening to this guy named Douglas Burdett, who I hear has a really good podcast. You might be doing a Google search and find a blogger. You might find an article on LinkedIn. These people are all influencing you the way the World Book used to influence me when I was young. And when I had a question, I went to the World Book, right? It's the same thing. If you are going to someplace for a source of information, I mean, I've worked with clients where they'll have a millennial doing their social media. And she's like, yeah, I read this blog post on, you know, how to run a social media contest. We're just going to copy what they did there. So whoever wrote that blog post on that social is influencing a lot of people. And this is the thing, that once you begin to create content and people consume that content, you become, you're influencing people to some extent, right? And therefore, it's not just photos on Instagram or videos on YouTube. It's blog posts. It's podcasts, right? And it's not just Instagram or TikTok or YouTube. It's LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, wherever you find that information. So when you think about it that way, and when you think that algorithms favor the people, right? This is how just, you know, we talk about the democratization of the publication of content and the consumption of content. What we don't talk a lot about is the democratization of media influence. It's the team at HarperCollins saying, you know what, Neil, traditional media outreach, you're probably better off reaching out to bloggers and podcasters mm-hmm. in 2020. And that is just a perfect example of an old traditional industry saying the best way to be heard today is through bloggers and podcasts. Not to say there's no value in media outreach if you have the connections, what have you, but it's not that same, you know, monopolization or monopoly of media influence that they used to have. Now, you know, the social media users just have more and more influence, and not everybody has influence, and it's not all the same, but more and more people have influence, especially with the visual social networks like YouTube, like Instagram, like TikTok. People that were really good at photography, videography, really just emerged, created great content, and were able to build communities from that. And now those communities are quite big.
Yeah, let's talk about social media. You talk about how a deeper understanding of how social media works is the first step in overcoming the challenges of, you know, organically building a brand. Remind listeners or explain to listeners what is meant when you say that social sites were not made for businesses, really.
Yeah. I mean, social media was made for people, right? Facebook was made for college students to get back in touch with each other. LinkedIn used to be a very, very closed professional network of only people you knew. Twitter was just, hey, what are you doing? Right. Mm-hmm. So none of these sites, and obviously as businesses emerge, business models emerge, and, you know, need to monetize emerges as well. But the whole concept of social media is that people, you know, log in every day and consume content there every day. And then if they do that, then, you know, social networks can now have advertising and make money from it. But if people stop coming, i.e. MySpace, then the company will go under. So, you know, Douglas, I forgetting if I wrote about this in the book, but when I had a chance to visit Facebook headquarters, One Hacker Way up there in the Bay Area, and I was told by their PR person who I was talking to that when you leave, it was on the old Sun Microsystems.
Oh, yeah. Campus. This was in the book. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So when you leave, so the Facebook campus is built on the old Sun Microsystems campus, and Sun, you know, had its days, bought out by Oracle. And, you know, apparently Mark Zuckerberg himself said, we don't want people to forget that, you know, we are in the campus of a company that went under because they failed to continue innovation or whatever you want to say, right? But they failed, right? And when you leave Facebook, they still have the old Sun Microsystems sign up that the employees see. On the other side, it has that Facebook thumbs up picture, right? That a lot of people take pictures in front of. But on the flip side, it still says Sun Microsystems for that reason. So every social network, the news feed is their lifeline. If people tune into the news feed and all they see is ads, they're going to stop going to a Facebook or to an Instagram. So there's always a delicate balance, you know, and when I was at Facebook, they're always were user first, and they have to be, right? But they have to monetize. So there's always this tricky balance of how much ad do we show and how much organic content from people we show. So if you think about it that way, where does the organic content of businesses fit in? It really doesn't. I mean, if there's inventory available, LinkedIn is a great network where they're actually promoting. I think companies with business pages might be surprised at how well they've done there recently.
Well, if it's good, if it's good content, but as you talked about how this balance that like a Facebook has to strike, it resonated with me because I'm seeing so many ads and I'm spending a whole lot less time on social media. But yeah. I thought about that. And then the fact that we're all so, I mean, the human brain, it catches on pretty quickly. And you see all these ads. I don't look at them. It's almost like I have a certain, you know, you talk about banner blindness on digital advertising where you just don't see that stuff. And I'm seeing the same thing. But then I'll zero in on a person. And wait. I'm getting ahead of myself. In this beginning of the book, you talk about how digital advertising has now surpassed traditional advertising. It was supposed to happen in 2019. Okay. So that's another point here. There's more digital than the traditional TV, print, and that sort of thing. But then it's going into the digital. And then most of the digital advertising is either on like on three websites, I believe, Amazon, Facebook, Google, something like that. And we're getting some blindness there where I don't want to see the ads. So that then helped me understand why the influencers are so powerful in working with companies, right?
Absolutely.
It was such a great setup.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, you know, you go to marketing conferences or social media marketing conferences and they have, you know, full days set apart for Facebook ads. To me, that is not social media. That's paid media, right? I mean, I understand there's unique targeting and what have you can do with it, but at the end of the day, it's an ad. And sure, if you find the right audience, the right, you might be successful. You might have positive ROI, but you're still not reaching everybody because so many people do tune it out as an advertisement. In fact, one of my clients was saying they didn't want to boost things to their followers because it would make them look cheap if they were advertising, which I thought was a very interesting perspective.
Yeah, but you know, you mentioned at one point that in the book that social media, paid social media, is like buying an enhanced telephone directory listing. I think that was in there. Either that or I inferred that. Because there used to have
water spigot, the water spigot analogy.
Right, right.
You need to meet API, turn on the water, and you'll be able to, you know, you'll get a good crop yield. So yeah, I mean, how much is it going to cost? I don't know. And, you know, we could say the same thing about influencers. If you want to get results by working with influencers, you're going to get some results. But if you work with enough of them, you'll get good results. So.
But as it relates to paid social, you mentioned that you don't take on clients unless they do have a paid social budget.
True. And the reason is that at the end of the day, when I work with a client, they have specific objectives. And in order to meet those objectives, which are usually aggressive objectives, that because social media is so important, yet organically, you're just not going to perform that well. There isn't. Now, obviously, now the conversation turns into paid social and or influencer marketing budget, right? But absolutely, because just with organic, your results are very, very limited compared to the potential.
Right. And I think most companies don't have that kind of time to wait.
Yeah. Exactly. And and you know, with coronavirus today, it's really interesting. And this is why I'm so excited to write my next book, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But you know, we finally got a majority digital ad spend 2019. What about today? There's no trade shows. You still have like TV. There's still some traditional advertising going on. But everybody now, I expect that 50, 55% digital this year to be 70, 80%. I mean, we finally hit the threshold.
Yeah, this pandemic has turned into such an accelerant for things that were going to happen anyway.
Yeah. So getting back to, you know, the way the ads work. So, you know, if your organic content isn't being seen and the ads are being ignored by a lot of people or look like ads, so they may not be as trustworthy, how are you going to get seen in the feed? And this is really where, you know, people rule the algorithms. You know, people are the reason why people log into social networks on a daily basis, right? Mm-hmm. They see their content and that's what keeps them coming, especially people that create great content that people engage with. And that those, generally speaking, are influencers. You know, they're at different levels, obviously. And that's why, you know, I remember, Douglas, back in the day, I don't know if you remember this, but Facebook was so viral that there were certain companies that were forwarding their website traffic to go to Facebook. I think Smartwater was one of them. And because they were reaching, you know, it was truly this case where, you know, 16% of the fans were seeing their content in newsfeed, and then they were actually, you know, liking and commenting on it. And that actually went out in the newsfeed that their friends saw that so-and-so liked something, right? It went out to the friends of fans and it began to get this viral, results. But that was back in like 2012. Those days are long gone. But that was the promise of organic social media marketing. It never happened. It's a supply and demand issue. It's a pay to play issue. And therefore, really, the only way to get results in organic is to work with other people to try to incite that word of mouth. And I just don't see any other way to do it today.
Yeah. So, Neil, not too long ago when I was doing the Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails, I spoke to your friend Lee Oden, who yes. is a real leader in the, and you mentioned him in the book, leader in the especially the B2B influencer area. And he talked about how one of the biggest mistakes companies make, this is probably B2B, B2C, anything, is that they treat influencer marketing as like a light switch or buying an ad or something like that. And several times in the book, you talk about why for influencer outreach or in marketing, to be effective, it has to be more of a marriage than a one-night stand. Talk about that, if you would, and what do you say to companies that still might look upon influencer marketing as some sort of quick hit they think they're going to get?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I often get asked, where do you find, you know, how do you convince people in your company to do all this? And I say, turn the clock back 10 years when social media marketing was just starting. There was a guy named Joseph Jaffe. Well, there was a lot of thought leaders and authors probably said this at the time, but social media is a commitment, not a campaign, because companies had a campaign based approach to social media. Oh, we'll do a social media campaign. People don't talk about that now, right? You have to invest in the long term and build community. And influencers are no different. So Lee at Top Rank Marketing, they call that always on, right? Mm-hmm. I call it building long term relationships to convert them into becoming brand advocates, because these are people we're dealing with. They're not programmable ad units. So if you only work with a person one time, you're trying to teach that person about your company, your culture, your brand, your product. They do an action, and then what happens to all that? It gets lost. There's no long-term asset in that. And really, what we're talking about, or what I'm trying to promote, is if you're going to work with someone, why wouldn't you invest? If you consider that person to be an influencer, why wouldn't you invest in that relationship to the point where they will talk about you long after any post that you might have done for them or any campaign you were involved with is done? I think that All Nippon Airways, Douglas, is a great example, because that was a brand ambassador program that I was on. They flew me out to Japan once. And that's where I went to the cabin attendant school. I went to the aircraft maintenance facility. I even had a chance to interview their whole marketing team about their branding and marketing. I got to fly in a 787 before you could fly in one in the United States. So it was an incredible experience, right? And then they brought me back again a year later in collaboration with the Okinawa Tourism Board and Hoshino Hotels to focus on that part of Japan. And we've kept in touch since then, right? So it's really, if you can become friends with influencers to the point where they become an advocate, then that's where you get the long-term benefits of word of mouth without you having to ask for it, because they already like, know, and trust you, or they love you. And that's why, Douglas, and this is something even more pronounced after I wrote the book, which I would talk even more about if I wrote the book today, you know, now brands are saying, well, the celebrities are celebrities. We want to work with people that are real, authentic, have more niche audiences. They're not buying fake. We want to go down to micro or nano influencers, right?
Yeah.
Nano influencers being a minimum 1,000. And they're also saying, you know, we want to work with people that already like, know, and trust us.
Yes.
We don't have, right? So you combine that, you know, in the book where I say, let's not look at this traditional, and I consider myself a disruptor because I'm not part of the traditional influencer marketing industry, which is very Instagram centric and which is only focused on the number of followers. Let's look at the brand affinity model, right? Let's look at your employees, your customers, your partners, your fans, people talking about you that you pick up in a social listening tool. These are people that already have some amount of like, know, and trust. And if you were to put them in a program where you treat them as an influencer, and this is why I think a lot of employee advocacy programs have failed, because they never treated employees as influencers.
Right.
You know, with that shift in mindset, you have a powerful army of influencers out there.
Yeah.
That you can activate and you can build an even deeper relationship with, deeper loyalty with. And that I believe is a solution. And Douglas, what's really great is since I've written the book, I've had a few influencer marketing agencies come out to say, Neil, you know, we're working with brands that are trying to do exactly that. And I talk in the book of a brand that I met in Singapore. They were the APAC headquarters of a major consumer packaged goods brand, global brand, and they were rolling out a new line of cosmetics. And they basically said, if we don't use influencer marketing, how else are we going to get the word out about our product? But what was more interesting that I don't think I wrote about in the book, this is an outtake, is that they were going to start a program to actually train their nano influencers. The nano influencers were fans of the brand, right?
Right.
And they were building them, but they weren't the best content creators. They were going to train them on how to take better photos,
oh, interesting,
how to take better videos, how to write better captions. And that's a model that any company can do for their employees, right?
Yeah.
And you know, if you're working with your customers and you're going to bring in you don't have to bring in a Kim Kardashian per se, but if you were going to bring in an influencer that people knew at a big level, you know, to come and help train you on how to take a better photo or video, how to better tell your story. I mean, there's tremendous benefits. We look at social media as an advertising platform. It's made for people. Not only is it a communication platform, but in the age of influence, it is an amazing collaboration platform.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to ask me the question, Douglas, but if there's one takeaway that you get of many, it's looking at social media as a way to collaborate with others to incite that word of mouth. And there's already people that know, like, and trust your brand. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, well, that became very clear to me. It revealed things or clarified things that made a lot of sense. And I guess I was aware of, but they hadn't all been put together. But I mean, All Nippon had an ongoing relationship with you. And here we are talking about that fine airline. But you know, Neil Schaefer, you're talking to a brand ambassador. Did you know that?
Douglas.
Me. Yes. I am a Maker's Mark brand ambassador. And I think somehow the company figured out there was an enormous consumption of their bourbon, you know, geolocated in my zip code. And they figured out that it was me. And so I don't know how that happened, but they send me stuff, and you know they're trying to get me out. And here I am talking about Maker's Mark Bourbon. But you know what? You mentioned Jason Falls earlier. He's worked with them. All the more reason I need to talk to my bourbon brother, Jason Falls, when his book comes out. I've never met him, but maybe you can put in a good word. You know, let's go back to what you were just talking about there about employees. Again, this was sort of a forehead slap for me. You write that, you know, employees are such a powerful and really untapped source of organic and you know, influential engagement. And I've often seen that employees have 10 times the reach. The average employee has like 10 times the reach of a company social media presence. Why is it such an untapped source for so many organizations? Are they just unaware, or what is it?
You know, I think it's a few different things. I think number one, we especially see there are still some companies, believe it or not, where the executive team does not use social media, distrusts social media, doesn't want their employees to use social media. There still is, and there's less of that with generation changes. This was really prominent like 10 years ago, right? Where IT departments would like block social media on corporate servers. I think a lot of those days are gone. It may still be the case in some companies, but you know, I think
maybe management thinks it's stupid, or it's something their grandchildren do to keep track of, you know, pop stars or something. Yeah.
It's a waste of time. Right. And I think there's also this traditional way of looking at marketing as being an advertisement.
Yeah, a promotion, so, a broadcasting.
Yeah. 4 P's, right? This is promotion.
Yes.
Social media, perfect.
Irritate them, blast them, you know, as if, you know, the currency now is attention. No one's paying attention. And let me just, again, I'm sorry, Neil, your book just got me fired up, but there was one part where you talk about how, and you mentioned this already, that you should treat your employees just like influencers because A, they are, but B, they don't want to spam their friends with things that they're not interested in sharing.
Yeah, you know, this is a case, the employee advocacy, just this whole history that there were forward-looking companies who started these programs. I'd say back in 2014, 15, we saw a number of tools come out in the technology. And the technology basically said, okay, marketing department, you put your stuff up in the server and you have your employees log into the tool and authorize the social networks. And then they can easily share the content you want them to share to their social networks. And that was the basic concept. So it was led by technology. And it was this great case of marketers using a tool without first thinking about what they were trying to achieve or a process that would be ideal.
Right. So like employees could say, sure, I'll opt into this program. And when the company tweets something out, you can use my Twitter account. In fact, I remember there was a tool that I had a trial of a few years ago, and I can't remember the name, but
yeah, there was Dynamic Signal, Gaggle Amp.
Gaggle Amp, that's the one. Yeah,
a number of these, and they're still around too, right?
Yeah.
But I think that they only saw the employees as a source of amplification. And while there were some tools that had the concept of, oh, let your employees decide what content to share, let them curate content that could be shared. It wasn't that collaboration. It was dictated mostly by marketing. They decided the content, and the content was the same old, you know, advertisement type of organic content that a lot of, you know, businesses are really good about talking about their products and services. But on social media, people are more interested in many ways of lifestyle type subjects, right? So that's where a lot of businesses with their social media marketing miss the boat. But they never had it. And then, you know, I hear of all these employee advocacy managers saying, oh, how do we get more employees to get involved? You know, how do we get them to share more content? When they should have, at the very beginning, said, hey, you know, we want to blow up our social channels. Do you have any ideas?
What would you like to share?
Would you like to write content for us? Right. And, you know, and it kills me when I see, you know, like technology companies that outsource content creation to agencies who don't know the technology, right? So It's like the IP is in your company. Aren't you letting, you know, if you were going to do a webinar, you probably have your star engineer developer on. Why aren't you working with them to develop content? In fact, why aren't you working with them to train them on social, to build them up as a rock star?
Yeah. Right. You know, I'm sorry, but I just got a quote from page 79. You say, employees are more trusted than corporate voices. Studies have shown that employees are more trusted than the CEO, the marketing and advertising departments, and more than an industry analyst. Oh, it's these companies are, you know, sitting on a gold mine, particularly B2B companies, of experts, very knowledgeable people. And I think the more imperfect these people appear, the more believable it is.
Absolutely. You know, that's what social media has taught us, is that, you know, we want to keep it real. We want to relate to what's real. And we're human. That's human nature. And that's where even now you talk about influencers being quote unquote vulnerable to show their failures. How many times do you hear a motivational speech where they start with the failure? That's human nature. We buy into it. In fact, they get more credibility when they talk about their failure to begin with, in a weird way. So this is just human nature, my friend.
Yeah, and I think we're suspicious of anything that's too slick. But in this digital world, you have to go even further to show a more human, believable side. And there've been some books on the show about that. Let's move on and talk about, you know, I think, again, back to somebody who's not familiar with this, they may think, oh, yes, let's get Neil Schafer's friend Kim Kardashian to tweet something. Okay.
Taco Tuesday.
Yeah. And actually, Kanye West, I think he's running for president. So he's probably going to be asking you some, you know, for some more advice. But
he tweeted it. It must be true.
Yeah. Well, actually, but I'm not sure which year it's going to be, but I'm excited about that. So what are some of the different ways to collaborate with influencers? There was a chapter on all these different ways. And as I was reading through it, as you mentioned each one, I thought, oh, of course, I've seen that done all the time. But I couldn't have come up with 16 ways to collaborate. And I don't expect you to talk about all of them. But what are some of the more popular ways that people are collaborating with influencers? And a lot of it has to do with content.
Yeah. So when I wrote the book, there were you know, it's like, okay, if we're going to work with influencers, what the heck could we do with them? And I am sort of, I mean, Maximize Your Social, I had one review say, this is like a cliff notes of how to do social media marketing. And that person said it in a negative way, right? But for me, my job, interestingly enough, as a professor, is to dumb these things down. So before social media, I was actually a salesman.
Hence, that's why the book resonated with me.
Well, I was a sales manager, right? And I realized that you need to dumb down concepts to get people on board to internalize them.
Or the other phrase might be simplify.
Yeah, simplify. To make it understandable from regardless of what a background or history you have, let's put it that way. So I don't think there's anything wrong with dumbing down. I don't want things, you can be as academic as you want, but if people don't internalize it, then you're not an educator. Mm-hmm. Or a successful consultant for that matter. So, when I put it that way, it's like, okay, what are just from a tangible, practical level, what are the different things that brands can do? And as I did my research on case studies of, influencer marketing case studies, as I reached out to more and more companies and influencers, and I started to compile all these stories, I go, okay, there's some patterns here. First of all, there's some stuff that we have already been doing that is influencer marketing, but it just never had that name, right? So we begin with blogger outreach. I mean, this is, reaching out to mommy bloggers before, social media. This was a big thing. They were influencers, right? We're hoping that we get mentioned in their media. Right? Affiliate marketing. We're reaching out to people that have web properties that get traffic because they're influencers. And we're hoping that they're going to pass some traffic onto us and generate some sales, in which case we're going to give them a commission. Mm-hmm. So just starting there, it's like, okay, we've already been doing this. So we begin to see that influence is everywhere, right? And I created this chapter of like the 16 different ways or 15 different ways. I think I've added one or two on since then, but these are just the practical ways. And it really begins with this sort of, these are the things you may have already been doing. You may have already been sending out product to influencers in hopes that they talk about it or, hey, here's a free 30-day trial or whatever it is. But when we get to, that's sort of like the traditional ways. When we get to the second part of, or the second section of these examples I give, they are very content centric because I wanted to make a point. My background's B2B, that this is as relevant. And Jay Baer would say that actually B2B, influencer marketing is more critical for B2B than B2C because you have less people making decisions, less information out there. That trust is even more important.
Yes.
So if we look at it that way, well, how do you influence B2B buyers? It's through content. They're looking for content. And think if they were looking for content and everybody was saying great things about your business, whereas your competitors weren't even being mentioned, right? So it comes down to that content. And the content, obviously, forgetting about the medium or the social network an interview is a type of content, obviously, where you go back and forth. It's guest blog posting, whether they guest on your blog or you guest on their blog. It's events, which are huge, right? Have corporate events, bring influencers in for webinars, especially after coronavirus. We see a lot of that. And the hope is, right, or a roundup post is another classic one. The hope is when Douglas Burdett interviews 20 marketing authors for an epic blog post about you need to do this today, this is what 20 expert marketing authors say. Right. And because you're working with an influencer like Douglas, every 21 of us would probably be sharing that article to our networks. Mm-hmm. Some of us may put it in our email newsletter that we were featured. Right. Some of us may write a little blog post about it. Hey, this is really great advice. You should check it out. By the way, it includes my advice as well.
Yeah, and now Neil Schaefer may actually share this interview. No pressure, Neil.
No, you're darn right. I will, of course, right? So, and that's the whole idea is that in B2B, we're sharing this information with our networks, and therefore the brands are getting that exposure that they're looking for through that action. But with B2B, it's content, right? It gets indexed, so it lives forever in Google search or in YouTube search, what have you. And if it's for a virtual trade show, there's leads that are generated. There are email addresses that people use. So those are, I think, with B2B, it's actually easier to see those very, very tangible benefits you can get when you work with the right influencers with this content centric B2B influencer marketing strategy.
Yeah, a big overarching theme that maybe it was because it resonated with me so much was the content. The content is so important to influencer marketing. Let's talk about just two other things in the remaining time. One was about measurement, and the other one I wanted to talk about was why every business should become more influential. So you write that there will be ROI on your influencer marketing investment. It's just a question of how much and how you measure it. How do you measure something as fluid as influencer marketing?
Well, it's the same thing with how do you measure marketing in general, right? Mm-hmm. We know that anything we do in digital or social is inherently more measurable, more trackable. We see it show up in Google Analytics, for instance. Whereas with traditional marketing, we don't see that. So then it comes down to, well, what is the campaign you're doing, right? So if content amplification being this, you know, traditional, hey, here's some content, or, you know, take a photo of our product and share that, what are the results that that gets? And how much would that have cost you if you were to do the same thing? And because it probably would cost companies to pay to play to get the same results. So you begin to create KPIs around what is the cost of website visit? What is the cost of a like? A cost of an impression? And you begin to put down these numbers and you really begin to compare apples and apples. And I think when it gets to the content piece, another thing that's happened since the publication of The Age of Influence is this big shift in not just seeing influencers for content amplification, but also for content creation, where brands are going out of their way to hire influencers to create content to replace their agency. Mm-hmm. So now we begin to look at what is the cost of content and how much do we save if we work with influencers? What is the cost of a physical trade show? And then what is the cost of a virtual trade show where we work with influencers to get maybe an even bigger audience? So these are the types of things that it really depends on the objective, because, you know, it's not just how you measure. It's first, what are you going to measure? And then what are you going to compare that to? Because there's always a way to compare it to traditional digital or traditional social media or paid social or paid digital. And then we compare the results, right? So, you know, it's a little bit holistic in you know, the perspective, but hopefully, you know, when I talk in these terms, you know, when we do a roundup post, what is the traffic that we get from that? What are the backlinks that we get from that? What are the leads generated from that? What are the sales generated from that? It's all measurable. It really just comes down to what is your objective with working with that influencer, and then actually measuring that through any one of the tools that you should have access to.
Yes, on page 200, you've got a big chart of all the things that can be measured. I think one of the larger issues, Neil, is that people should be measuring it, and they can measure it. Let me just add that, again, a very quotable book. The return on your investment comes down to three simple questions. Are you ready, listener? One, what was your objective? Two, and this is a yes or no, did you achieve it? Three, at what cost? You know, Neil, this may just be me, but sometimes when I'm over the years, I've been talking to companies and you'll be talking to about maybe a new approach they should be taking. And I got to believe that every week you're talking to companies that are maybe trying to put a toe in influencer marketing. So it's new to them. And they'll want to know the ROI. They want to know that. And sometimes at some point I learned to not answer the question right away. And I say, well, that's an interesting question. Tell me, how are you currently measuring your marketing investment? And again, maybe it's just me, but more than half the time they say, well, we're not really measuring it.
Crickets, right?
Yeah. Well, and so I always find that interesting that they suddenly want to measure something new. Maybe it's because they think, you know, well, we can measure that better than whatever they've been doing in the past. But that usually moves the question on. So I think to a lot of listeners out there who are getting this ROI pushback, find out how they've been measuring it in the first place. Now, maybe they have been measuring it, but they aren't good metrics. Right off the bat, you're able to say, well, look, we can measure even more than that. What do you think about that? So let's talk about, there's one section at the end about why every business should become more influential. And I was writing all over that. And frankly, I was writing little notes to share with clients or prospects that are kind of on the fence. But explain what I think is an enormous opportunity for companies as it relates to the 99-1 ratio.
The classic 99-1 ratio, which yes. Actually is from...
That's 90-9-1 for those visual learners.
That, That's actually from, I believe it was originally in The Influentials, a book that was published maybe 15 years ago. It might have, I think it actually came from a theory or study shortly before that, but this was.
Okay, but let me also come to Neil Schafer's defense. He's got about 10 or 15 pages of small type footnotes, and I was circling things back there. Because I would see a footnote and I would go back there and circle it because I'm stealing it for a presentation. It was great. No,
and you know what?
I'm sure you cited it.
I did cite it. I want to give a shout out though. I first saw it in a presentation done by Michael Brito, who another fantastic marketing author. So I want to give a shout out to him.
Okay.
And when I first saw it was like 5 years ago, and it was about the power of content creators. But you know, when the theory first came out, it was this: on the internet, 90% of internet users are lurkers. 9% might comment. Well, back then you couldn't engage, so I guess commenting was the thing you do. And 1% are content creators. And I think that this is very, very relevant for looking at social media today, because not all of us are content creators, right? And I even remember I spoke at iStrategy, this conference, and shout out to our fans in the UK. This was a great conference they used to put on many moons ago in the UK. And I'll never forget the country manager for Twitter UK saying that, you know, 70% of Twitter users don't tweet. Now, today we know that there's a lot of bots and, you know, influence in elections and coronavirus is a lie and all that. But take that away, there's still a lot of people that just don't post. It's like you see people on Instagram, they haven't posted in a year, and then all of a sudden you DM them and they reply immediately.
Yeah, well, didn't you talk in the book about Twitter, like at least 60% don't
do anything? That was the number. Yeah, okay, maybe it was 60%. So, but when we look at it this way, so LinkedIn has, let's say, 500 million users. It's probably close to 6. So of the 500 million users, only 5 million are probably posting content regularly. And then you have another maybe 45 million, that 9%, that might not be posting their own content, but they're posting other people's content, or they might be commenting or engaging. But there's still 90% of users that don't do any of that. And I think it's a really, really relevant way of looking at social media, that when you're working with an influencer, even if they don't have the influence that you might want, that they are at the heart of it, a content creator. They are part of that 1%. And maybe on Instagram, content creators are more like 2, 3, 4, or 5%. I don't know. But it's still a very, very small percentage that we're working with. And it is, you know, a group of VIP users. Now, with Instagram, that 1% is more like, you know, 10 million instead of LinkedIn's 5 million, but it's a lot of people. So it's not like in any industry, there's only one or two influencers. There are a lot of people out there that you can work with. And getting back to, you know, why I wrote the chapter of the more influential you are, the better it is for your business, is because when you reach out to an influencer, now, if they already like, know, and trust you, that's great. But people will judge you by how influential they think you look. If they go to your Facebook fan page and it's crickets and 100 fans, or they see 5,000 fans and some engagement and maybe a recent Facebook Live that you did, inherently, you're going to look better. You're going to have more credibility to who your brand is. And then, you know, influencers, when you're pitching them, if they don't know your brand, they're going to size you up. And if they think you're an influential brand, chances are they may want to work with you more, or chances are they may give you preferential benefits like cheaper costs or more or what have you, because they genuinely are more interested in working with you. So
yes,
this once again ties into, you know, human psychology and social proof, right? And we could go back to Robert Cialdini's influence.
Right. And also, I think the influencer would think there's some momentum here. I'm not going to have to carry all the water for this company, who probably has unrealistic expectations for what the influencer can do.
Well, that too. And then, you know, influencers love to write on their resume, I've worked with Brand A, I've worked with All Nippon Airways. They would love to put a more recognizable brand on their resume, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why I think for startups, it's a challenge. But you know, the more influencers you can work with, you can, on the flip side, say, hey, we work with Kim Kardashian, we work with Douglas Bardet, we work with LeBron James. It's the same type of thing that can work in your favor.
Thank you for including me in that group. I can dream, can't I? Well, Neil Schafer, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Man, I just hope that they would look at marketing, they would just do a reset and just look at holistically. what the hell are you doing? And this goes beyond influencer marketing with coronavirus. You know, what is the message? How are you serving your community? And I do believe that that role of leveraging other users is a really, really impactful and real and authentic way. You know, I know that you've had other authors that talk about humanizing your brand.
Yeah.
I don't think your brand, at the end of the day, you're a for-profit corporation, right? Only people can truly humanize your brand. Now, obviously, your employees are some of those people, but it's really hard for a logo to humanize itself. And I know that some brands do better than others, but I think the ultimate solution is don't do the talking yourself. Let others do the talking for you. It's believable. It's relatable. You're going to win more friends, more fans, and it's the best way forward to fight this war with the algorithms that we should stop fighting, because organic social media is never going to work for 99% of companies. So find the way around it. And the best workaround, and with all these other benefits, is working with influencers. So think about that as you do a reset. And with the coronavirus, I know many companies are doing resets and everything they're doing. They're going more digital. And as part of that, hopefully you look at influencer marketing a little bit differently. And you say, just like social media marketing 10 years ago, we're going to take, you know, maybe then you took 5% of your marketing budget from SEO. We're going to take 5% of our Facebook ads budget. So instead of investing in Facebook, we're actually going to invest in people.
Yes, I can sense that, based on history, all these social media platforms are going to come and go. But I don't think that working with people that have built their own audience, who are known, liked, and trusted, is ever going to go out of style. And it seems like there might be people at companies who read this book and might think the following: gosh, we've been doing this the hard way. You know, they're trying to do more of what just isn't working, and they're looking at this and they're thinking, okay. I see how this works. So that would be my hope. But what is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the many ideas from your book?
Well, I think one of the things to do is to look at your content and see if there's a way you can start to have influencers create that content for you. And what I mean by this is you're leveraging what we call user-generated content, right? But you're being strategic in that you're looking at your employees, you're looking at your customers, you're looking at your followers, and you're beginning to sort of look as to who might already be creating great content out there. Who is a blogger? Who's a photographer?
Yes.
So I think it starts with taking asset of who your assets are, of who are those people that know, like, and trust you, and start there. And for employees, just one little ninja tactic here. One of the easiest way to do this is if you have, I know we have a lot of salespeople listening. Shout out to all the great salespeople out there.
Yes.
Is if you have LinkedIn Sales Navigator, and every salesperson in B2B probably has LinkedIn Sales Navigator, you can do a search on a company or, you know, a lead or whatever you want to call it in Sales Navigator, and you can see which employees have posted on LinkedIn in the past 30 days. And getting back to the 991, I mean, it depends on the company, obviously, but that's going to be your first, you know, way of finding people in your company that might be more influential. And believe it or not, in B2B companies, the only types of employee advocacy programs that were successful, I believe, were those that were rolled into social selling programs. So now for a lot of companies in B2B, your salespeople just might be the biggest influencers. Mm-hmm. So just something to think about. As I know we mainly have marketers listening, but you really need to look at your salespeople that were early on. They were getting LinkedIn. They were already sharing content. They've become, you know, a resource for people in the network, which includes customers and prospects. So maybe that's a great place for especially B2B companies to start.
Great idea. Neil Schaefer, is there any chance or interest on your part of writing a book about social selling? Not to put you on the spot, but it just seemed like, I mean, you work with companies about this, you were in sales, you understand social media.
Douglas, before your podcast, when you reached out to me, I published a book called Maximize Your Social in 2013. Mm-hmm. I actually had written two books before that. So back in 2011.
About the LinkedIn, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Maximizing LinkedIn for Sales and Social Media Marketing. Now, back in 2011, we didn't have a term for social selling.
Yeah.
Right.
You were talking about it before it was cool.
Yeah, we didn't have a concept for employee advocacy where I actually talked about how your outward, your public-facing employees should all be on LinkedIn and be active. So that is the closest social selling book that I have. I do regularly publish a free ebook on maximizing LinkedIn for business where I give a lot of this advice as well. Find it on my website. And you know, the next book I think is going to be more about digital marketing, more of a general book. But yeah, there's always been a book I've wanted to write, you know, more specifically about social selling today. And I think I have the content to do that. So maybe I'll shift gears. We shall see.
Well, Neil Schaefer, you should know that I'm full of ideas that I don't have to implement. But just to make sure people know, so you mentioned the 2013 Maximize Your Social. And then in 2009, Windmill Networking, Understanding, Leveraging, and Maximizing LinkedIn, an unofficial step-by-step guide to creating and implementing your LinkedIn brand. And then what was next? 2011, Maximizing LinkedIn for Sales and Social Media Marketing, an unofficial practical guide to selling and developing B2B business on LinkedIn. And I guess it was the lawyers at LinkedIn that probably made you want to put unofficial on there. And then...
Amen, brother.
Hey, we love our lawyers. In 2015, Maximizing LinkedIn for Business. So anyway, well, I knew about those, but I just had to ask that question. Are there any, besides the books you mentioned by Jason Falls and the professor at the University of Texas, are there any other new books that you've heard of, maybe haven't read yet, that you're looking forward to seeing come out or that have already come out?
Wow. You know what? There's another few books. Those are the two books that are really top of mind with me.
Yeah.
We've seen some free eBooks. So I know that Joe Polizzi and Martin Lindstrom, two of my favorite authors, have put together these eBooks about coronavirus marketing.
Yes. And I interviewed them both about that on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. I'll include links to those interviews about those two. That is a great recommendation. Those two specific eBooks. And I think they're both free.
Yes. You might have, the Joe Polizzi one's easier to find. Martin Lindstrom, I'm not sure where you can access it, but yes, it's out there.
Yeah. Well, I'll include links to it and I'll include links to their interviews. But those were really interesting, very helpful. And that's why Joe Polizzi was the only author that came on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails twice. It's not because he enjoys drinking, but he was drinking Tito's vodka during the interviews. But I think his wife needed a break and she, said, "Hey, can you talk to him again? I got to get some things done. He's hanging around here at the house a little too much." So
Joe must have like a solar panel attached to his brain. He is always on.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I'm a big fan of his. And I saw that you mentioned him in the book. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable that you've talked about. We're going to include a link to your site and your LinkedIn profile. And I hope that listeners will go there and connect with you. And thank you for being on the Marketing Book Podcast and putting up with my really stupid jokes. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone, you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found right now, unless you're driving, by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Age of Influence, The Power of Influencers to Elevate Your Brand. The author is Neil Schaefer. Neil, thank you very much for joining us again on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, it's been an absolute honor. I was expecting even cornier jokes, so I think you did really well. I think you may have to work on your jokes a little bit more, but I look forward to being back again when I have that next book, and it's going to be a lot sooner than 2025, my friend. I promise you.
Okay. And thank you for implying that I work on my jokes. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of effort and time that goes into them, but they are free. So, hey, what are you going to do?
There you go.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.